And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your preposterously genial host, John Derbyshire, this third weekend of April 2024. Like last week's, this is one of my pre-recorded podcasts. It will go out on the airwaves April 19th, picking up where the April 12th edition left off. If you listened to or read last week's, you will remember that I was replaying Radio Derb segments from April's past, from April 2006 to April 2016. Today I pluck segments from the following years, 2017 to 2023. One segment from the third week of April each year. That will complete our two-week trip down memory lane. Next week, April 26th, I shall be podcasting from the VDare.com conference in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Normal service will then resume with material that is farm fresh, not frozen. Let us then continue our voyage through the third week of April's past, as recorded for posterity by Radio Derb. What is my attitude to the Me Too movement? One of deep scepticism. While I'm trawling in my archives, I may as well give a mention to a column I wrote in February 2001, a modest, qualified appreciation of Bill O'Reilly, to whose show on Fox News I had become mildly addicted. That was 16 years ago. The addiction wore off, but I've checked in with the Big Mick from time to time, when 8 o'clock comes around and I have nothing much else I feel like doing. It's easy watching and it's sometimes interesting. It was, I should say. As no doubt you all know by now, Fox News has dropped O'Reilly. The cause of the dropping is given as sexual harassment on Bill's part towards female staffers. I've totally lost touch with what the phrase sexual harassment means nowadays, so I browsed some of the news stories. Here's one of O'Reilly's accusers, Perquita Burgess, who was a temp at Fox News some years ago. How many years ago? Nobody seems to know, but it was sometime prior to 2010. Samples from Ms. Burgess, as reported in the newspapers, quote, 3 to 4 weeks after she was hired, they were on the elevator alone. She says he let her off the elevator first. As he was walking in front of her, he said, looking good there, girl, which was the first time he spoke to her. End quote. Oh, the humanity. Second quote. I should say that Miss Burgess is a mulatto, or possibly a quadroon. Quote, Burgess claims that when she was eating lunch outside one day, O'Reilly saw her and said, hey, hot chocolate, as he walked past her without looking at her. She was mortified, she told The View. That's some kind of TV program. And she took it as a, quote, very plantational remark. Plantational. End quote. Well, earlier this month, the New York Times reported that Fox News and O'Reilly between them
had paid out $13 million to various women accusers. That report prompted advertisers to pull out from O'Reilly's show, although his viewership actually increased. What to make of all this? Colour me sceptical. In the first place, if Perquita Burgess's stories are representative, Bill was no more than boorish, a thing women knew how to deal with when I was doing office work. Heck, they had a whole repertoire of ways to deal with it, ranging from the icy stare to a knee in the groin. Trust me on this. What happened to "I am woman, hear me roar"? I thought women were supposed to be powerful and defiant nowadays, modelling themselves on the fearless little girl facing down the bull on the Wall Street traffic island. With Miss Burgess, it's more a case of "I am woman, hear me whimper." And the guy's 67 years old. Do younger Americans have any idea how tiresome it is trying to keep up with social decorums that change week by week? I honestly did not know that saying "looking good there, girl" to a female office colleague is insulting. How much time does Miss Burgess spend dressing and putting her makeup on in the morning in order to, you know, look good? Next week, I suppose a breezy "good morning" will count as sexual harassment. Things seem to be headed in the same direction they've gone in Britain, where elderly gentlemen with distinguished careers in show business and the public service are humiliated and bankrupted because some neurotic female claims he put his hand on her knee back in 1973. I don't know the truth about what Bill O'Reilly did, and neither do you. It looks to me, though, like a lawyer's ramp. Bill O'Reilly and Fox News have deep pockets. In the mental atmosphere of today, when there is no greater glory than to declare oneself a victim American, especially if your victimizer is a white male, and doubly especially if he is a conservative, this stuff will naturally come up like crabgrass on a springtime lawn. It goes without saying, of course, that the social justice warriors, now hyperventilating about Bill O'Reilly complimenting some broad's looks, were cheering on a different Bill, Bill Clinton, when he was banging interns two at a time across the Oval Office desk. What lying, hypocritical scum these people are. Well, Bill's gone, and I'll miss him. A little. He had a screen presence that not many TV presenters have. Something about the guy kept you watching. I've tuned into The Factor a couple of times this week when Dana Perino's been hosting. She's fine. She speaks clearly, asks intelligent questions, doesn't embarrass herself. At the risk of ending up in the next prison cell to O'Reilly, I'll even add that she's easy on the eye. And yet, no presence. After 10 minutes watching, I feel an irresistible urge to go hammer some nails into wood. If some of the news reports are to be believed, what O'Reilly's defenestration actually represents is an instance of Robert Conquest's second law of politics. Just to remind you, Conquest's three laws are: 1. Everyone is conservative about what he knows best. 2. Any organisation not explicitly and constitutionally right-wing will sooner or later become left-wing. 3. The behaviour of any bureaucratic organisation can best be understood by assuming that it is controlled by a secret cabal of its enemies. Well, Fox News is falling victim to the second law. New York Daily News, April 19th, headline: Rupert Murdoch's sons, progressive wives, helped oust Bill O'Reilly from Fox News Channel. Rupert Murdoch, the Fox News supremo, is 86 years old and presumably just as tired as you or I will be at that age. His 40-something sons, James and Lachlan, are both metropolitan sophisticates, with trophy wives who are even more so. You can imagine how icky they find an older white guy like O'Reilly, with his Neanderthal opinions and his 1970-ish social habits. Ew! Fox News is not, so far as I know, explicitly and constitutionally right-wing. Conquest's second law, therefore, decrees that it will become left-wing, like the rest of the legacy media. Tucker Carlson, watch your back.
One of the great milestones in modern immigration patriotism was British politician Enoch Powell's Birmingham speech of 1968. April 20th, 2018, was the 50th anniversary. Also this week, today in fact, April 20th, falls the 50th anniversary of British politician Enoch Powell's Birmingham speech against mass third world immigration into his country. Our boss, Peter Brimelow, has an eloquent post about this on the main site, which I should say, by the way, is somewhat at sixes and sevens this weekend, as our techies have migrated from one presentation technology to another, with the inevitable glitches. Be forgiving, please, while we sort them out. You can read Powell's speech in its entirety on the internet. There are YouTube clips of him actually delivering bits of it, although apparently the entire thing was not recorded. Here are the opening two sentences. Quote, "The supreme function of statesmanship is to provide against preventable evils. In seeking to do so, it encounters obstacles which are deeply rooted in human nature." End quote. Powell's speech is commonly called the Rivers of Blood speech, but that's a misnomer. There is only one river in it, the River Tiber, on which Rome was built. Near the end of the speech, Powell said, quote, "As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see, inner quote, the River Tiber foaming with much blood." End inner quote, end quote. That inner quote is from Book 6 of the Aeneid. Aeneas, the hero of the epic, consults with the Cumaean Sibyl, asking her what the future holds. The Sibyl looks into her crystal ball and says the thing that Powell famously quoted. According to Powell's biographer, he first gave the quote in Latin. "Et tibrim multo spumantem sanguine cerno." Then he translated it into English for the benefit of audience members who'd forgotten their Virgil. Embarrassingly for Powell, who had been a professor of classics before he went into politics, The Cumaean Sibyl was Greek, not Roman. So, strictly speaking, he should have said, like the Greek. We Powell fans generally give him a pass on that. Virgil, who wrote the epic, was definitely a Roman. So the words that Virgil put into the Sibyl's mouth were his words by copyright. That snippet of Latin aside, Powell's classicism shows through at several points in the speech. Here, for example, where he's enlarging on those obstacles that hinder human nature from dealing with preventable evils. Quote, above all, people are disposed to mistake predicting troubles for causing troubles, and even for desiring troubles. If only, they love to think, if only people wouldn't talk about it, it probably wouldn't happen. Perhaps this habit goes back to the primitive belief that the word and the thing, the name and the object, are identical. End quote. That last sentence there is straight out of Sir James Fraser's strange and fascinating book, The Golden Bough, which a classicist of Powell's generation would certainly have read, and whose title is itself taken from an episode in the Aeneid. For me, a math geek, the bit of Powell's speech I most often quote is, quote, numbers are of the essence. The significance and consequences of an alien element introduced into a country or population are profoundly different according to whether that element is 1% or 10%. End quote. Powell's biographer tells us he doubled down on that in an interview that he gave to the Daily Mail after the speech. Quote from the biography. Asked whether he was a racialist, he answered, in a quote, we are all racialists. Do I object to one coloured person in this country? No. To 100? No. To 1,000? No. To 1,000,000? A query. To 5,000,000? Definitely. End in a quote, end quote. There were two things at the front of Powell's mind when he prepared the Rivers of Blood speech. One of them was us, the Americans. Powell and his wife had spent 3 weeks in the USA the previous fall. We were at that point still in the throes of the civil rights movement, and events over here had given Powell much food for thought. There is a reference at the end of the speech, quote, that tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic, but which there is interwoven with the history and existence of the states itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect. End quote. The other thing at the front of Powell's mind in April 1968 was the Race Relations Bill of that year, which was at that time making its way through Parliament, and which would ban racial discrimination in private exchanges like property rentals. Quote from the speech. There could be no grosser misconception of the realities than is entertained by those who vociferously demand legislation, as they call it, against discrimination. They have got it exactly and diametrically wrong. The discrimination and the deprivation, the sense of alarm and of resentment, lies not with the immigrant population, but with those among whom they have come and are still coming. End quote. Enoch Powell was a great man, a brilliant man, both literate and numerate, and a fine patriot. His speech isn't just for the Brits. Anyone of any nation can read it with profit. Nor was it just of its time. It is still pertinent today. I don't pontificate much about religion, but in April 2019, with the next year's election at the back of my mind, I voiced some reflections. Returning to the religious theme, and speaking of polls, Gallup published a new poll this week on religiosity in America. Headline: U.S. church membership down sharply in past 2 decades. The first 2 paragraphs of the story tell the tale. Quote: as Christian and Jewish Americans prepare to celebrate Easter and Passover, respectively, Gallup finds the percentage of Americans who report belonging to a church, synagogue, or mosque at an all-time low, averaging 50% in 2018. U.S. church membership was 70% or higher from 1937 through 1976, falling modestly to an average of 68%. So that's just a 2% drop in the 1970s through the 1990s. The past 20 years have seen an acceleration in the drop-off, with a 20 percentage point decline since 1999. And more than half of that change occurring since the start of the current decade. End quote. The key factor in declining church membership, Gallup says, is the percentage of Americans telling pollsters they have no religious affiliation. That percentage has more than doubled since the year 2000, from 8% to 19%. That accords with my own impressions. When I started full-time writing for conservative outlets 20 years ago, religion was a big issue. A lot of conservatives, notably the late Larry Oster, jeered at me as not religious enough to be writing for outlets like National Review. Intelligent Design, which I wrote unflattering things about, was a big issue. Big enough to get me a mention in the New York Times. That all seems like a long time ago now. I haven't read National Review for a while, but in the dissident right outlets that I follow, UNS Review, Occidental Dissent, AmRen, The Z-Man, religion is well-nigh invisible. Even more traditional conservative websites like Front Page and American Thinker don't bother with it much. How does that square with my opening assertion that religiosity is a core feature of human nature? I don't see any contradiction. For one thing, we have way more outlets for our religiosity now than we used to have. Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Catholic, that old palette of religious choices seems as quaint now as having only 3 TV networks to watch. Citizens who grew up with 40 different breakfast cereals to choose from want more variety in their religious experiences. The Pew Research Center told us last year that practitioners of New Age spiritual cults, Wiccans, neo-paganists, Eastern mystics and the rest, now outnumber Presbyterians. And then we learned from the 20th century, if we didn't know it before, that when traditional religion has been outlawed, religious passions just get redirected to ideology. Look at the ecstasies released by China's Cultural Revolution 50 years ago. Something like that has happened to us too this past 20 years. As John McWhorter observed in a landmark essay 4 years ago, the anti-racist ideology of our good white overclass is a full-dress religion, complete with priests, liturgy, diversity is our strength, original sin, and a day of judgment. Likewise with anti-Trumpism. Watching the reaction of Democratic politicians and commentators to the Mueller report this week, you can't help thinking of those cults where everybody goes up the mountain to wait for the world to end. Then, when the apocalypse fails to happen, instead of trudging back down the mountain disillusioned, their passion and their conviction only intensify. They start demanding a review of the sacred texts to see if maybe they just got the date wrong. In April 2020, we were flooded with news stories about the COVID pandemic. The main thing those stories were informative about was the innumeracy of journalists. Concerning the pandemic itself, I don't have a lot to say, for reasons I aired 2 weeks ago. I am still, for example, I'm still getting a daily report in my New York Post on, quote, cases. That is, number of recorded cases of COVID-19 by city, state and nation. Recorded how? Number of hospital admissions? Well, then why not say so? Number of tests positive? Out of how many tested? 2,000 positives out of 3,000 tested? Or 2,000 positives out of 1,000,000 tested? It's rare to see clear numbers spelled out. It's likewise rare to see anything on the opportunity cost side of the ledger. An acquaintance of mine is connected with NAPA, North American Partners in Anesthesia, which is obviously a professional association for anesthesiologists. They have fallen on hard times, my acquaintance tells me, because so many of the procedures that require an anesthesiologist, deep surgery, for example, have been put on hold while hospitals handled coronavirus patients. A different acquaintance, familiar with admissions to a nearby hospital emergency room, tells me they are turning away cases that they would not have turned away before to free up space for virus patients. With so much of the nation's medical resources reoriented to coronavirus cases like this, there must be some opportunity cost, surely including some deaths. Costs in health failure from other causes. Has anyone tried to quantify that? I haven't seen it, and until I do, I shall assume that the numbers for coronavirus deaths need qualification they're not getting. The general level of scientific and numerical understanding in mainstream commentary has improved some this past month, but it's still low. Journalism schools don't teach much math or statistics, I'm guessing. Tucker Carlson, for example, had his regular medical reporter, a doctor named Mark Siegel, he had the doctor take a test for the virus on air this past Monday. This is a new test developed by a lab in Chicago. We were told that, quote, "This is a rapid diagnostic test that will generate an accurate diagnosis within 5 minutes if the patient is positive for COVID, and up to 13 minutes if they are negative," end quote. Dr. Siegel tested negative. Well, that's great. Watching the segment, though, I was waiting for someone, Carlson or Dr. Siegel or the pathologist administering the test, I was waiting for someone to utter one of the following two phrases: false positive or false negative. Nobody did. Yet, those are key things you want to know about any medical test, especially a brand new test on a virus that has only recently come to our attention. Random story from the week's news. This was the London Daily Mail, April 16th. Headline: "Nurse who twice needed hospital treatment for coronavirus casts doubt on the effectiveness of COVID-19 swabs after she tested negative three times." The nurse in this story is Nicole Williams, age not given but looks to be no more than 30, trim and fit, of Cardiff in Wales. Because she's a nurse, when she started getting symptoms, she was tested right away. The test came back negative. The symptoms got worse. She was tested again, twice. Negative, negative. A fourth test came up positive. The lady is now recovering, I'm glad to say. So, next time you see some TV talking head promoting a virus test, be sure to yell at the TV screen, "False positives! False negatives! What are the numbers?" Looters, rioters, and Ashley Babbitt. The unfairness of it all. Here's a phrase due for an airing: asymmetry of indulgence. That phrase was coined, so far as I know, by conservative British journalist Ferdinand Mount. He was writing about how leftist politicians get a pass, an indulgence, when they speak in the globalist-universalist diction of Karl Marx and Mao Zedong. But when a conservative dares to murmur that perhaps rampant multiculturalism is not a great idea, he is denounced as literally Hitler. Plainly, we have an asymmetry of indulgence in regard to police shootings of civilians. The asymmetry was in exceptionally plain sight this week after the shooting of Daunte Wright in a Minneapolis suburb. The tiny minority of us whose memories stretch all the way back to early January could not help contrasting this shooting and its consequences with the death of Ashley Babbitt. Possibly armed black male with an arrest warrant already extant is accidentally shot dead by white female cop. Nationwide outrage. Cop is fired and charged with homicide. city manager who said the cop was entitled to due process is also fired. Mass rioting and looting. Obviously unarmed white female is deliberately shot dead by black male cop without challenge or warning. As Steve Saylor noted, the who-whom principle doesn't get any more in your face than that. There is more to be said, though. There are always two ways to correct an imbalance. You can add some weight on the light side of the balance arm, or you can subtract some weight from the heavier side. So there's a small faction here on the dissident right, I've occasionally glimpsed them in the comment threads, arguing that it was right to shoot Ashley Babbitt, and that the real wrong here has been not shooting a whole lot more people. The rioters, the arsonists and looters of Antifa and BLM. If Ms. Babbitt had been shot, and a few dozen rioters also, we'd be in balance. No more asymmetry of indulgence. What does Radio Derb think of this argument? I'm not totally unsympathetic. It is shameful and outrageous that the public authorities in Minnesota tolerate the mass disorder, violence and destruction that we've been seeing this week. Again. I have a strong preference for living in an orderly society that deals with anarchists swiftly and firmly. In my darker moods, when I'm watching coverage of the Minnesota riots, my thoughts drift to flamethrowers, helicopter gunships, and napalm. Rubber bullets? What's wrong with real bullets? The name Pinochet keeps bobbing to the surface. On calm reflection, though, my sympathies come out more mixed. On the matter of looting, for example, it certainly is heartbreaking to think of Joe and Sally Citizen starting up a little business in Main Street, a liquor store perhaps, investing their life savings in it, only to see it looted and burned by street predators. But, contrariwise, it's hard to summon up tears for big chain retailers like Foot Locker and Target when their corporate spokesmen have expressed solidarity with the rioters. Foot Locker has actually donated $200 million to BLM this past year. Loot them again! And on the other side of the balance, I have more than once spoken up for some measured turbulence against ruling class targets. It's good and healthy for our smug, pampered elites to have a few of their windows broken now and then. Perhaps it'll concentrate their minds, those few of them who have any minds. So, what's the bottom line here, Derb? Enough of this on the one hand, on the other hand, equivocation. Did Ashley Babbitt get what was coming to her, or what? Should we shoot more street rioters, or what? Yes, I think we should shoot more rioters. Looters, definitely. Although, with looters of big, woke corporate retailers, a low priority. Guys capering on the roofs of police cars? Sure, if you can get a decently horizontal line of sight. If you shoot up at the bastard and miss,
your bullet might end up in someone's living room 100 yards away. Window breakers? Now and then, for salutary purposes. But no, Ashley Babbitt did not get what was coming to her. What was coming to her was a challenge, a warning, and some physical restraint by the cops she was surrounded by. And yes, I would say the same of the looters. Give them plenty of warning before shooting. That is professional law enforcement. What happened to Miss Babbitt was a shameful travesty of law enforcement, and the silence on it, enforced by the regime and its media lackeys, is outrageous. To cycle round to where I started, the contrast between the two deaths, Ashley Babbitt's and Daunte Wright's, tells us all too plainly where we are. Where are we? Not in any realm of reason and considered seeking for a proper point of balance, as I have just there been trying to do. Even as I was trying, I was reflecting on the futility of trying. I was trained in math, the realm of reason and logic. I was trained to prove theorems. In the arena of public commentary and mass belief today, there are no theorems, no logic, no reason. There are only dark shadows, delusions, jungle superstitions, screeched emotions, innumerate assumptions, and indifference to naked contradictions. Logic, reason, theorems? Pah, white supremacist stuff. We have, as the late Larry Oster told us, we have descended into an ersatz religion, with black people as the sacred objects. The emblematic image of our time is Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, a white man, kneeling in reverent supplication before the gilded casket of Black Street thug George Floyd. White people are bad. Black people are good. You didn't know that? The rising generations know it. It's taught to them in kindergarten. You may say that's entirely appropriate for such an infantile set of ideas, but it sticks. In the world of the mid-21st century, if the USA is still around, which I increasingly doubt, most Americans will stand on it as the foundation of their social outlook. I'm sorry to have started off on such a low note. For those of us raised in a different time, learning from books, in classrooms under strict discipline, all the madness and stupidity of current discourse is deeply depressing. We feel, we honestly feel, that we are living in an asylum. I have my personal comforts, the love of a close family, the literature of the past, theorems to prove. The rest of you must cope as best you can. God help us all.
Radio Derb is not a dark pit of total negativity. I often make constructive suggestions, as here in April 2022 on Britain's immigration crisis.
I mentioned Rwanda back there, I forget why. You remember Rwanda? Well, if you're over 35, you do. Small country in East Central Africa. Hutus and Tutsis, got it? Right. Well, Rwanda's in the news. The actual story here is Britain's problem with illegal third world immigration. They are swarming in across the English Channel from France. More than 5,000 so far this year, and that's with high winds and rough seas. The British government expects more than 60,000 this year. That will be double last year's number, which was triple the previous year's, which was five times the year before that's. The Brits are running out of graph paper to plot these numbers. The illegals, mainly unemployable young men from Africa and the Middle East, cross the channel in small boats laid on for them by smugglers operating from France. The French authorities, of course, cooperate with the smugglers. They don't want these people in their country. And the illegals don't want to be in France either. Benefits in Britain are much better. And they have relatives and contacts in Britain, and more likely speak English than French. The British establishment are complete pussies about the whole thing. The official term for the illegals, happily parroted by the media there, is asylum seekers. In fact, the great majority are economic migrants, with enough money to pay $5,000 or so for a place on a boat. They bring nothing to Britain but pressure on housing and welfare services and the certainty of more crime, terrorism and ethnic discord. The British government, headed by a lightweight globalist buffoon named Boris Johnson, has been doing nothing about this for 4 years now. And this is a government drawn from the ruling Conservative Party. The country's other main parties are even bigger pussies than the Conservatives. They would replace the smugglers' business model with a government-funded ferry service. My solution, if I were running the British government, would be hulks. That was the name given to decommissioned military ships moored offshore and used to handle the overflow from Britain's prisons in the 18th and 19th centuries. One of my great-great-grandfathers spent time on a prison hulk while awaiting transportation to Australia. The Brits must have plenty of unwanted military and commercial vessels they could easily fit out as hulks, using those 19th century hulks as a design guide. The accommodation need only be very basic. Heck, if hulks were good enough for my great-great-granddaddy George, they should damn well be good enough for some Iranian or Senegalese wetback. Well, public discontent has been rising, and even Johnson has felt obliged to do something. What he's done is, he has cut a deal with the government of Rwanda for them to take the illegals off his hands. The idea is that when illegals arrive in Britain, they are given some kind of assessment to determine whether they are economic migrants or genuine refugees in distress. Economic migrants will be parked in old military bases and then flown to Rwanda, with no legal right to return to Britain. In return for the Rwandans' hospitality, Britain will pay them a big slab of money. $156 million, says the government, although critics who've worked the numbers say it's more like $1.8 billion. If it all sounds a bit far-fetched, it is. The Brits have a mass of so-called human rights laws on their books to prevent almost any assertion of national interest against foreigners. A lot of it was inspired, encouraged and practiced by the extremely woke Sherry Blair, horrible wife of the loathsome Tony Blair, who was Britain's Prime Minister for 10 years, 1997 to 2007. As a result, there is now a mighty, powerful core of human rights lawyers active. These lawyers will leap to the defence of illegals awaiting transportation to Rwanda, postponing their removal indefinitely with innumerable court actions, injunctions and so on. Furthermore, the Johnson government is seriously unpopular for reasons nothing to do with immigration, to do with COVID, the cost of living, law and order and so on. They will probably be voted out in the next election. The party that replaces them will, as I have said, be even more illegal friendly than the Johnson crowd. Rescinding the agreement with Rwanda will be their first priority. Hulks might have worked. This Rwanda ploy is just a bunch of globalist airheads trying to look as if they're doing something.
Do politicians lie? Of course they do. Do they lie nowadays more than they used to? If so, why? I pondered it all in 2023. If you'll excuse me, I'm just going to recycle an old favourite of mine. That sneaky little more than 10 million in the New York Times piece brought it to mind. That and the front page of yesterday's New York Post, which happens to be lying on my desk. The Post front page is dominated by two words in very large print. Biden lied. There's a picture of our president below that, with, as background, a great crowd of illegals at the southern border wall. So, those were my prompts reminding me of that old favourite. It's a little journalistic gem from 40 years ago. That I know I have quoted before more than once, but which bears re-quoting now and then. This was Timothy Garton Ash, a writer with long experience of dealing with communists in Eastern Europe. Here he was, writing in the London Spectator, August 13th, 1983. Quote, imagine sitting round a table with four apparently sane and civilised men, the senior of whom suddenly remarks, "Of course, the earth is flat." You expect the others to demur, but no. "Flat," says one. "Very flat," agrees his neighbour. "How else could we walk upright?" exclaims the third. And then they all smile at you, challenging dissent. Far-fetched? If you travel to communist countries as a journalist, this is a regular experience. You are ushered into a large government office, greeted with elaborate politeness by the minister or party secretary, seated at a glass-topped table under the marquetry plaque of Lenin. A middle-aged secretary brings in cups of coffee, plates of small cakes, perhaps a round of schnapps. And then they start quietly telling you these whopping lies. End quote. I had just returned to England after living for a year in China when that came out, so I could relate to it with no difficulty at all. Yes, that was a common experience in communist countries, and no doubt it still is. The key background point was explained to us some years later by a different commentator, Theodore Dalrymple. Quote from him. In my study of communist societies, I came to the conclusion that the purpose of communist propaganda was not to persuade or convince, nor to inform, but to humiliate. End quote. Our own politicians have always lied, of course. They didn't used to lie any more than necessary, though, and their lies were furtive and obfuscated as far as possible by tricks of language and presentation. It seems to me that those older styles of political mendacity are now giving way to the more brazen communist style. Our politicians lie to us now, right to our faces. And then they all smile at you, challenging dissent. Dalrymple was right. Nothing is more psychologically painful, more destructive of the individual ego, than humiliation. Joe Biden leads the way here, as that New York Post cover story makes clear. Back in January, when the administration pretended to tighten up the rules for citizens of Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua, the president said, quote, "But if their application for asylum, made online or at a point of entry, is denied, or if they attempt to cross into the United States unlawfully, they will be returned back to Mexico and will not be eligible for this program after that." End quote. As the New York Post story makes clear, that was a barefaced lie. At just one of the 70-odd checkpoints on our southern border, just one checkpoint, an average of 300 people a day from those countries are being waved through without process. And how many times has Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas assured us, looking straight into the camera, that the border is secure? I don't know how many times altogether, but I can tell you the most recent time. It was Wednesday this week. And then there's US Attorney General Merrick Garland and the investigation of Hunter Biden's taxes and foreign business dealings. A federal grand jury in Delaware has been conducting that investigation since, according to the Associated Press, at least 2018. Just savour that for a moment. A grand jury labouring away for 5 years on a matter mainly to do with tax evasion. Do the grand jurors have any lives outside the jury room? Do they have jobs to keep or businesses to run? I'd like to know. Could it be that the Biden administration has, at any rate for the last two of those 5 years, been deliberately holding up the investigation? Which I presume for the prior 3 years had been stalled by the political power structure in Delaware, which is the Biden's home ground? Absolutely not, Comrade Garland told a congressional committee last month. No way. Impossible. We are now hearing, however, that a whistleblower has emerged from the IRS to claim that Comrade Garland was lying. The whistleblower, well, actually his attorney, says he has evidence. They lie. We know they're lying, and they know we know. They don't care that we know. The object is not persuasion, it's humiliation. To break our wills and make us obedient subjects of the all-knowing, all-powerful state. I might as well have stayed in China. As always, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening and for your emails and your kind donations. Next week, the podcast will return to using only farm fresh material, nothing frozen. I shall be at the Berkeley Springs Castle attending VDare.com's annual conference. Best wishes to all.